Basket case. That's the basket case. Now we'll see what questions we've got in here today. Very good. The first question today. Dear Ajahn, what is the origin of the Jataka stories Theragatha started when during the Buddha's time? Thank you, the Jataka tales. They're just stories. They're supposed to be previous life stories of the Buddha. Some are, some aren't, because they've been accumulated over such a long time, the Jataka tales. But it doesn't really matter whether they are truly past life stories of the Buddha or not. Some of them are very useful, and they're very, very funny as well. One of the ones which I like was the story of this, because we just had a meeting of for the monks after every full moon day, and the new moon day we have a meeting of the monks over in Bodhinyana Monastery. So this one comes to mind, because there's one monk who can't stop talking. And as the senior monk, oh, sometimes it drives you crazy. And I remember this was a Jataka tale, that there was a king a long time ago, and he had one of his ministers. And as soon as anything came up for discussion in court, the minister would open his mouth. And this is what I think I should do. I know the best because I know everything. I've been around a long time, and this minister just would not stop. And so hardly anything got done. You couldn't really just have good meetings. So the poor king was just really having a big headache, went for a walk in his garden, and he saw something which gave him an idea. He saw this man in a wheelchair who was making a living, because if you're in a wheelchair, it's very hard to make a living. He had one of these little things called a pea shooter. I remember having when I was a kid, a tube. And you put a little pea in the end, you can blow it. And because it's a tube, you can aim it pretty accurately. And this man in a wheelchair was so skilled at using his pea shooter that the kids, when they came out of school, would give him a few pennies, a couple of dollars here, a few rupees there. And they'd say, see that tree over there? Sculpt it. And he sculpts it into like a chicken. By taking off all the leaves, many, many leaves, until the tree was sculpted. Or just like an elephant. You've seen these gardens where people use the clippers to shape the bushes and trees like animals. That's what he could do, but just with the pea shooter. And the kids would give him money for this. And he was so accurate and so quick and so good. That's how he made a living. And the king had an idea. And he came up to that poor man, and whispered in his ear, and then they agreed. And the following morning, there was another meeting, and this minister didn't realize there was a new curtain on the back of the wall. He didn't really think twice of it. But as soon as the first matter for business came up, raising taxes or something, the minister started opening his mouth and giving his opinion. And amazing, as soon as he opened his mouth, he felt something hit the back of his throat and gulped it down. That didn't stop him though, because you can't really stop these people talking. However, and every time he opened his mouth, another thing hit, gulped it down, carried on, nothing would stop him. And many times, 20, 30, 40, 50 times, but after about 50 or 60 of these things hit the back of his throat and he gulped it down, he started to feel really sick inside his stomach. His stomach started to turn, but he kept on talking. And he started going green. And he wanted to vomit, but he would keep on talking. And he talked and talked until he could stand it no longer. He held his hand over his mouth and ran away. He never came back for days. But as soon as he ran out, the king was giving high fives to everybody. He was so happy. And he took aside the curtain. Of course, it was this guy with his pea shooter. But he didn't have peas, had his big sack, it was very big at first, but almost finished, of chicken poo. You know the little pellets of chicken dung? Just right for a pea shooter. Another bit of dung into this guy's throat. And from that time on, the king got lots of business done, and when that minister came back, whenever he would speak, which was very rarely from now on, he'd always put his hand over his mouth, as you see some people do these days. So that was a jarring concern about some people speaking a lot and just the very skillful means of stopping them. So this afternoon I was thinking that we should have one of those in our monastery. But don't tell him that, please. So that's the Jataka tales. Some are true life stories, and some are actually very interesting. One of the most interesting Jataka tales is actually in the Gatikara. It's a sutta. The whole sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya is one of the Buddha's previous life stories. And this is a fascinating one because it is authentic, and it's probably, you know, most people say, well, this is absolutely true. It really changes a lot of people's ideas about things like bodhisattvas, previous Buddhas. Because this one, the Buddha was passing a place and he was talking to Ananda and he said, oh, you know, a long, long, long time ago, there was a potter called Gatikara. And he was a disciple of the previous Buddha, Kassapa. We never think in Buddhism that things are new or special. If there was a Buddha now, there was a Buddha before. If there was this life, why not a previous life and the next life? If there's one universe, why not more universes? That's Buddhism, basically. The whole idea of you being unique, you being special, this planet being special, this time being special, that's just real arrogance. But anyway, the previous Buddha, and Gatikara was one of his disciples, and he was really close to being enlightened. He was what we call like a non-returner, as a layperson. And some of you might come across people who say, I'm enlightened, I'm a non-returner too. Now this is actually how you can tell who is a non-returner, as a layperson. Because this guy, the only reason why he didn't ordain and become a bhikkhu, a monk, was because he had two parents who were both blind. And you know that, you know, in not just Buddhism, it should be everywhere. We really respect and look after our parents. They looked after us when we were incapable. If they become incapable, we have to look after them. So he was looking after his two elderly parents who were both blind. But he was a potter by trade. And he was just so sensitive that he would never dig the earth to get clay in case his spade dissected a worm or he squashed a beetle. He was so sensitive as a non-returner to other beings. He would only just collect earth left over when the farmers made their paddy field dikes or when some animal dug into the ground to make a nest, he'd carry the earth there. And that's what he used to make his pots. A total harmless being. And number two, he wouldn't go selling his pots. He wasn't into business and commercial stuff at all. And this is actually his lack of attachment to stuff of the world. He would just make his pots, put them on a bench outside his hut and say, anyone want a pot, just take one. And if you want to leave me some rice and some beans for my food and my parents' food, please leave some. Never saying how much, and just take what you want and please help me just keep alive. And that's how he got by. Now that is a fascinating story of just what it's like to be someone who's almost enlightened. You've got no sort of attachments at all to that stuff of the world. So we'd never get into business. We'd just take a pot if you want it. Don't leave it. And he's looking after his parents. But of course, he was a very devout disciple of Kassapa the Buddha, and he also had his best friend called Jyotipala. His best friend Jyotipala was one of these people, you probably have friends or acquaintances like this, didn't want to have anything to do with any type of religion at all. And when you talk about your Buddhism, come to tell you, you're stupid, you know, that's just a lot of Gomayang religion and stuff. And this is actually what this Jyotipala kept on saying. He said, oh, you're Buddha. You should get a proper job and instead of just sitting there and just sucking up all the resources of other people. What does he do to get? He just sits there and you give him stuff, lazy, good for nothing. And he was really, really critical of Kassapa the Buddha, this Jyotipala. He called him all sorts of bad names. But his friend, Gatikara, he used every trick he could possibly do, and eventually got this Jyotipala to see the Buddha. Let's go and see him. And of course, as soon as Jyotipala saw the Buddha, he was so inspired that Jyotipala asked to become a monk, and became a monk under Kassapa the Buddha. And the story goes on another tangent, but I stop there because at the end of the story, the Buddha, our Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, said, I was Jyotipala. That was me in my previous life. Our Buddha, the Buddha of our age, in a previous Buddha, couldn't even recognize who this Buddha was. And sort of even criticized him and called him names. And I often quote that because sometimes people say, well, when our Buddha was born, was he already sort of halfway on the path of enlightenment? Or just, did he find this all out by himself? Under the Bodhi tree, all the traditions say that after getting into the jhanas, one of the first things he did was remember his previous lives. He remembered his previous lives and one of them, and in the whole series of cosmological universes coming and going, this was really recent. I'm sure he must have remembered his previous life as a monk disciple under Kassapa the Buddha. Surely he would have remembered what he was taught. That is where the Buddhism came from. So that's a Jataka, which has huge implications on many of the misassumptions which people have about Buddhism. People think, oh, he practiced for many, many lifetimes, really becoming this incredible being, so spiritual, over many, many eons of existence, but on a very nearly, almost his last life, he couldn't even recognize a Buddha when he was living with him. So, that is some of the benefits of some of the Jataka tales. Some of them really give you a big picture of what's going on. And the Terakata, Terigata, that's really nice having a look at those, because those are verses of enlightened nuns. Women in the time of the Buddha, bhikkhunis, who became fully enlightened. And as I was saying to someone, who was it, to a Sri Lankan couple who came to offer dance, they said, look, this is what we had in the time of the Buddha, and it's great, we're bringing it back again with bhikkhunis over there. It's been gone for centuries, why we don't know, but we're bringing it back to its original state. What a wonderful thing that is, and you're part of that, well done. So, but when did it start? We don't know exactly when it started, but there's certainly many of the nuns who you read in other places were contemporary to the Buddha. And there is some really interesting stories in there too, which made everything just human. Sometimes we think that these people were super women or super men in the time of the Buddha, but they weren't, they're just like each one of you. And one of the Terigata stories, I'm not going to get many questions done tonight, one of these Terigata stories, which I usually say at the end of the retreat, but I'm going to say it now because it just comes up. There was this nun who had been meditating for 7 long years. And, you know, she wrote about her experiences in this poem. 7 years, and I was not even one moment of peace. Now, 9 days is not that long. Imagine 7 years, never getting anywhere in your meditation. And so when 7 years came up, there was a bit of a watershed for, oh, crikey, what should I do? And in the poem, she said, well, I don't want to go back to the 3 crooked things. And that's an idiom. You learn how these idioms they have in those times. We all have idioms. You know, raining cats and dogs. The 3 crooked things, the first crooked thing was supposed to be the house broom, which she had to use to sweep the house. She didn't want to go back to housework. So the 2nd crooked thing was the ladle to make the curry. She didn't want to go back to cooking. So those were the 2 crooked things. The broom symbolizing housework, the ladle symbolizing cooking. And the third crooked thing was the husband. You don't want to go back to the three crooked things. So in Egypt of those days, the three crooked things is housework, the broom, the ladle, and the husband. I had enough of that. So she couldn't really get any peace in meditation. She couldn't want to go back to, you know, living in the worldly life. So what should she do? Had only one choice. She went into the forest with a long length of rope. She climbed a tree and she tied one end of the rope to a big branch of the tree and the other one around her neck. She was about to commit suicide. And just before she jumped off, then she had her enlightenment moment. And so she untied the rope and she became another enlightened nun. And then she wrote a poem about it. Now that is many methods of enlightenment. That is not recommended. Please do not do that here. Otherwise you get into trouble. But I often, that's one of the Therigata, that's how she got enlightened. I often, why did that happen? She was trying for 7 years. And what happened? She let go. Gave up. What's the point? That is when you start getting peaceful. Stopping, letting go. So you don't need to go to that extent to let go. So anyway, that's why those books have got some really interesting, not sort of the theory, but like life stories of what a person was like and how they, you know, became enlightened. Fascinating stuff. And fortunately, the translation which is around is just really old and not really that good. So, who's done any new translations? Therigata? Not really yet. It's one thing which is waiting for a decent translator because it's brilliant stuff. Anyway, that's those two. Now, a complicated one. Okay, here we go. When sound contacts ears, ear consciousness arises, also arises leading to feeling. But in dependent origination, consciousness, vijnana, I call it consciousnesses, arises before number and rupa and six sense bases and contact. Is it the same consciousness, vijnana, or different? Okay, it is because the nama and rupa, now the problem here, one of the big problems for you is if you just follow suttas, what the Buddha said, nama rupa means one thing, vijnana means one thing. But if you follow the Abhidharma and the commentary, it means something totally different. So actually, and this is one point where the Abhidharma, which comes later, really just muddies everything. It doesn't follow the way the Buddha described nama and rupa and vijnana. So I always keep to what the Buddha said. Vijnana, nama rupa, they're two sheaves of reeds. Using the simile of living in farming communities, when you've got reeds or you've got wheat or whatever, to dry them, you lean one against the other. They support each other. But if you take one away, the other one falls. And that's what the Buddha said. This nama rupa and vijnana, they depend upon one another. So nama rupa causes vijnana, vijnana causes nama rupa. So which comes first? Chicken or egg? You need a chicken to have an egg, and from the egg comes a chicken. So that's the same really question you're asking here. So they all come together. But the interesting thing about that consciousness is, there's six types of consciousness, is. And just making it plural like it should be, instead of consciousness, consciousnesses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, knowing, they're totally different animals. But we all lump them together and say consciousness. We think it's the same thing, basically. This consciousnesses. When one comes, the other one vanishes. Then the other one comes up, and the first one is gone. If you look at it this way, change your way of perceiving, it's very easy to see that none of these is you. But however, when one sees all these consciousnesses, they all have to depend on the other sheaf of reeds. Nama rupa is basically something to be conscious of, an object. If there's no object of consciousness, consciousness turns off. Consciousness is not permanent, always there. It arises and passes away, depending on having something to be conscious of. So you cannot be conscious, aware, without being aware of something. And that something has to always be changing. If it stays still, consciousness turns off. Which is why there is no eternal, beautiful, wonderful consciousness. All consciousness, in any form, is suffering, impermanent, not who you really are. But anyway, I read your book simply this moment, a collection of talks on Buddhism practice. You wrote, vijnana is doer. But how about the citta? I didn't say the vijnana is doer. The doer is will. Sankara, chetana, just using it in those terms, that's the doer. I wrote the vijnanas, especially mano vijnana, is the knower. The two, the knower and the doer. The citta, that is the knower as well. Even, this is a technical question, even if you look at things like the Brahmajala Sutta, wrong view number 8, and the Buddha says, what they call vijnana or citta or mana, that's the other word for mind, this is showing the or means these are alternatives. Just like these days we say your heart or your mind or your consciousness, these are just different ways of saying the same word. This is talking to ordinary people, you use language loosely. So the Buddha was saying that. So that's what this is. Anyway, that was the technical question. In your view, what does it mean to call yourself a Buddhist? If a secular Buddhist keeps precepts and meditates yet rejects the teachings of rebirth, does that qualify? Is there a dividing line? Okay, do we have like in Catholicism, you know, you have to have, what's it, a catechism or something? You have to sort of chant something and say you believe in this and then you're a Christian. Even like for me, people asked me once, they asked me, were you baptized? I said, yeah, I was, but it was against my will. I have no choice in the matter. I said, oh, you're a Christian. No, I'm not. I refuse to accept that. Can I be unbaptized? Well, anyway. But, so why call yourself a Buddhist? I would say that there's all types of different Buddhists, but as long as your whole worldview, it sort of is similar enough to what you hear from the teachings of the Buddha, where that you're not going to take on face value what's written in books as being the truth. They're a guide. They're not sort of literal absolute truth. And you are going to commit yourself, you know, to a way of finding out that truth for yourself, not listening to books, following guides like, you know, wise monks, nuns, teachers, following them and committing yourself to learning what that truth is. So, and that also means, you know, there's a certain moral code which is expected of a Buddhist, and just that will usually come about as your wisdom grows anyway. You know, when it comes to precepts, that's just what a sensible person does. It doesn't make any sense, you know, to take things like alcohol. You can have much more fun without it. And you know, why would you kill somebody or just steal? It's ridiculous ideas. Committing adultery, lying. It's only stupid people do such stuff. They feel there's something in it for them. They usually get more trouble. So this is actually where the Buddhist becomes wise and the precepts become from the wisdom. And then they start learning how to meditate, and that is their path to wisdom, stillness, silence. And when it comes to teaching rebirth, if someone rejects the teachings of rebirth, then I'd say there's a problem there. You're rejecting it. At the very least, you should keep an open mind. Out of faith in the Buddha and many other people who say that that is a fact of life, you have been reborn before, you should not reject it. But keep an open mind until you get enough decent meditation, you can find out for yourself. So this, when people reject it, that is being too dogmatic. You know, it's just saying it doesn't exist without even doing the experiment to find out. So that is the bit where you can still call yourself a Buddhist, but you're not a very wise Buddhist if you reject things without really finding out for yourself. And anyway, there is such a thing as rebirth. so, and I often tell people, don't really worry too much about it, because if you don't believe in rebirth in this life, you will in your next. That's a lovely joke. Okay, is it true if... So can you please make short questions, because some of these are just so refined. Being a Sotapanna starts from the six sense bases, and is divided into two groups. The six sense bases, I don't know where you get that one from. Anyway, the first group is called Sadhanusari, the fourth, the faith follower, a person who believes that visible objects, sounds and mental objects are impermanent, always changing. I don't know where you got that one from. The second group is called Dhammanusari, the truth follower. Practitioners in this group don't use faith or belief, but they understand by the insight that visible objects are impermanent. Practitioners in these two groups will not die before realizing the Buddha stream entry. Is it true if they will not die before realizing? Number one, that's not really what the faith follower is and what the Dhamma follower is. These are the faith follower is this huge group of people, and it overlaps, you know, those who go through experience or personal knowledge, you know, usually in deep meditation. So either you believe what the Buddha said about things like rebirth, non-self, suffering, totally, and you just accept that almost just without any doubt, that type of faith. And, you know, if you believe that, then you're going to practice according to what the Buddha said. And a sign that you're a faith follower, at the very least you're keeping the five precepts, and you're going to the temple, you're meditating. Because if it really means faith, this is what the Buddha said to do, so you do it. So that type of faith actually has a lot of obligations to it. The trouble with faith, though, you don't know who you're having faith in, you might get it wrong. So that's the trouble with faith, it's a very dangerous path. That is why that people always want to have their own experience, test it out for themselves. If you have some experience, you know, of things like impermanence, non-self, you know, the whole suffering, everything, then you have the experience, and that is a bit more reliable. So what happens usually, that people always have a combination of faith and experience. If it's more experience than faith, you call the Dhammanusari. More faith than experience, the Sadhanusari. But it's not just one or the other. It's just, you know, just how much of each. And it's not just six senses are impermanent. That's one of the big problems. It's so easy to see things come and go, but real impermanence, anicca, does not mean just things come and go. It means that they vanish. Looking at the lake and seeing the water or the waves rise and fall, that is not anicca, that is so superficial. Just like you see the lady come from the left to the right, that's easy. But if I saw her suddenly just vanish in thin air, she's there and then suddenly gone, that's anicca. Things which you always thought were permanent, stable, reliable, totally disappear. And that shocks you. That is what the real impermanence is. And that's very hard. To see all the five senses totally vanish, that's jhana. To see the sixth sense, the mind, vanish, that's the immaterial stuff. That is no small thing to see that. That's the real stimulus. Why is waking up to reality a natural process? It's a natural process because the mind is always inclining towards happiness. That's a natural process. In life, whether it's sweet food, whether it's the type of food you like, whether it's laying in a nice soft bed, which going out to the sunshine when you're cold, turning on the air con when you're hot, why do you do that? That's natural. It's just the body and the mind seeking for happiness. And that seeking for happiness, that natural process, eventually lead you to seeing the Dhamma. Understanding suffering and the end of suffering. The pursuit of happiness. It's your right according to the United States Constitution. And so the United States Constitution, which guarantees the right to pursuit happiness, guarantees Buddhism. This is the pursuit of happiness. the escape from suffering. That's what the Buddha kept on saying. The only thing he ever teaches is suffering and the end of suffering. That's what it's all about. So it is a natural process because your mind will incline towards happiness. It will come along to many dead-end streets of happiness, whether it's drugs, alcohol, doing well in life, amassing stuff, relationships, sex. You go many, many places, and you go to the end of that and say, this is not really satisfying. It's sort of okay, but it's not good enough. And eventually you come to this meditation, and something happens. Say, wow, this is really happiness. This is profound. This is the peace, the fulfillment I was searching for. And that leads you on into the real awakening to what real happiness is. When old memories come into your mind all the time, when you sit for meditation, what should you do? Chase them away. The more you chase them away, the more they will come back to you. So instead, welcome old memories. Now, when you use reverse psychology, welcome old memories, and you look after them, you cherish them, then some of those old memories you can actually see are just unpleasant. They're rubbish memories. What you can do is write them down. Write down all those old memories which come in meditation and give them to me. And I'll read them out in the evening. This is Ananda's old memories today. And you get so embarrassed, this rubbish stuff. That's why there are monks who can read your mind. That is one of the things which happens naturally when you start meditating. But you don't have to worry at all. Once you've read a couple of minds, you never want to read a mind ever again. It's rubbish. Honestly, who would really want to spend time looking at your mind and your old memories and thoughts? So you're perfectly safe there. So, old memories keep coming. Why? Don't try and chase them away. Investigate. Why do they keep coming? Why is it that sometimes you're at home and you look at all these reruns, or you get old movies, you download them? Why do you keep doing all this old stuff? Because you're bored, that's why. You're not content, you're not happy. So your mind just goes into this filing cabinet of fantasies, old memories, or even plans. It's just escaping, that's all. So why are you escaping into old memories? It's because you're not really content being here. You want to go somewhere else, anywhere else. So that's why, if the memories come, let them come. Be content in this moment. Bring those old memories and make them your present moment. And being content, oh, it's an old memory. So you're actually not in the past anymore. You're watching this now. And you're content. Because you're content and peaceful in this moment, those old memories, they just fade, they evaporate. And then you're just in this moment. Chasing them away is a problem. Controlling again. Which means you're not really happy being here. You know, the old memory, I don't want this. That causes more old memories or fantasies to come up. So, the most important thing in meditation, this is an important point, it's not what you are aware of. That's not important at all. Old memories, sexual fantasy, planning what you can do next, that's not important. What is important is, how are you aware of that? Are you letting it be? Are you opening the door of your heart to this moment with compassion? Are you making peace with this? Being kind, being gentle? If that's what you're doing, you are meditating. It's not what you're aware of, but how you are aware. How you react to things, not the things which are in your mind. The things which are in your mind right now is a result of old karma. What you're doing with them is the present karma. There is where you make great meditation happen. Make peace, be kind, be gentle with your own memories. And then you find they vanish and you get some really great meditation. Chase them away, that's too much negativity. Too much control. Could you please explain how to make a proper bow prostrations? Up, down, up, down, up, down. Doesn't really matter. Bowing, but okay, you can do. Who's going to do it? Benito, come on, you're at the very end here. Please demonstrate how to bow. How to bow properly. So you see, he starts off with his hands up in front of his nose, and he goes down before him. His head should go between the hands, and then go back up again. And smile a lot, yes. And now, please show how not to bow. Usually you see this with people. And that's it. Now don't go anywhere. Yes, that's like that, yeah. So, but that is just physical. The most important thing is how to bow is, again, your attitude. If you're just bowing just because everyone else is doing it, that's not a really good reason. Should be a bowing as a way of respect. So you're respecting sort of what you're bowing to. And when I bow, I've told this to a lot of people, when I first bow to a Buddha, I always think of virtue. Second bow, to peace. Third, to compassion. Sometimes to wisdom. I swap them around. So when I bow to a Buddha, I remember virtue, peace, and compassion. That's what I'm bowing down to. I respect those things. And that makes me mindful, aware, keep on recollecting the importance of virtue, peace, and compassion. So I love bowing to those things. So when you know what you're bowing to, that's more important than actually how you bow. And if it's to the monks or the nuns, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a good monk or a bad nun, it doesn't really matter. Or I should go the other way around, otherwise people say, why do you say bad nun and good monk Ajahn Brahm? Got to be very careful these days. Okay, good nun and bad monk. It doesn't really matter as long as, because this is the symbol of what a monk and nun should be. So that's actually what you do when you're doing the bowing. That's what I suggest. If you have other things you really respect, and not just virtue, it can be like compassion, sila samadhi panya, it could be, just all the great dharma you've heard from the Buddha, you bow to that, the great example. Whatever you see, you bow to that. You don't bow to the statue, you bow to what it represents. Can you please give the precise, oh my goodness, precise sutra reference to the two monks meditating, the nodding and the other sitting upright. The Buddha praises not a stopping man. I don't believe you. Thanks. Okay, I'll get that for you tomorrow. I don't know exactly where it is. I think it's, you know where it is? Some U-turn somewhere. It's in there somewhere. But anyway, we'll get that for you the next day. Very good. What do they use to unlock the monastery gates? This is a joke. What do they use to unlock monastery gates? Monkeys. Monkeys. Monk keys. That's not bad. So what do they use to lock the the gates at Dharamsala? I don't know. Okay. Combination locks, I don't know. How I overcome the short concentration by not bothering about concentration. Concentration is not where it's at. If you try to overcome short concentration, the very fact you're trying to overcome it means that you are trying to do something. And that's the reason why your mind is wandering all over the place. Change your aim from concentrating to stillness. So see how you can become still. Forget about concentration, just stillness. Settle down, relax. And then all the things which you thought you'd achieve through concentration, sustained awareness for long periods of time, being able to watch the breath for hours, happily, that comes from stillness, not concentration. So put your mind directing towards stillness, not concentration. If I is an illusion in the Buddhist idea, how can I get rid of the I? You can't get rid of the I. Because, you know, I cannot kill the I. It's just like in Oliver Twist, Charles Dickens, they had this fellow who had always said, if I think Oliver comes back with a £5 note, I'll eat my own head. So can you eat your own head? You can contemplate it, but you can't actually do it. There's a problem there. You need a mouth to eat, and if you eat your own mouth, you've got nothing to eat. It's just impossible. So an eye can't get rid of the eye. So you don't get rid of the eye. You realize there was nothing there to begin with. A realization, not an extermination. You are not the Terminator who's come there to sort of get rid of this sense of self. If we get rid of the eye, you don't get rid of the eye vanishes. We get rid of everything in our life. How about our parents? Thank you. Exterminate your parents, exterminate your wife. I used to see that Doctor Who when I was a kid. It's still going apparently, Doctor Who. With the Daleks. Do you know the Daleks in Doctor Who? Exterminate, exterminate. They're still doing the same thing after all these, they haven't grown up at all, these Daleks. They're still exterminating everything. You think they'd come across Buddhism, instead of exterminate, they'd say, be still, be compassionate. And they radiate not these laser beams from their little, the toilet plunger in their front. They'd radiate rays of compassion and kindness. Enlightened Daleks, instead of saying exterminate, compassionate. Anyway, I better work on that one from. You all know Doctor Who? Daleks? Okay, they're still going. Okay, very good. I thought it was just people of my age. Just being, non-doing. But you wrote this, you did something. Just be in oneness with life, Buddha nature, God, universal intelligence, or whatever names we give to it. Be still and know, be awake. I guess this is what meditation is about. Not really. Stop putting it into words. Just be still. And then all the words vanish. Just be in oneness. Now, people go from diversity to oneness, but we go to the next stage, from one to none. Disappear. Because that's not going far enough. Merging in the oneness. Merge in the none. Disappear. Vanish. That is the best. What was it? Just before Christmas. Yeah, because I told a story the first time in Penang. Some guy came up to me, he's a sort of a friend, and he decided, he was a Christian. He decided to be cheeky with me. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, look, I've known you for a long time, but honestly, nothing is better than God. And I said, I totally agree with you. Nothing is much better than your God. The emptiness, disappearance, everything vanishing. It's much higher than God or Jesus. He was very upset. He said, that's not what I meant. So better than oneness is numbness. So merge. Not merge, disappear, vanish in the universal nothingness. That's right. Be a nobody. I had this t-shirt I saw. It said, nobody is perfect, was the first line on the t-shirt. Second line, I'm a nobody. Third line, therefore I must be perfect. So true, isn't it? Nobody is perfect. So if you really want to be perfect, then be a nobody. Become enlightened. Vanish. Be a nobody. It's much better than being a somebody. After relaxing, the pain seems to come back again. This relaxing coming back seems to continue. How to work, please advise. So it's not relaxing deep enough. Relax the body so much, the pain goes. And where it goes, who knows? But it don't come back again. Because people are so impatient. They think the first day they can become enlightened. I know you're very busy people, have got lots of things to do. But one day is not enough. Just keep on going and it gets better and better and better. My mind gets obsessed about someone I love. Can't stop and be still. Please help. Okay. Very easy solution. This, well, story, Ajahn Chah's story. I was in the back of the car when this happened. There was a novice monk, Gary, remember him, and in the car was a great teacher. And the teacher read this guy's mind, looked at him and said, "You're thinking about your girlfriend back in LA. He was from the United States. He nailed him. And this poor monk got so embarrassed, caught him fantasizing about his girlfriend, which he left behind in Los Angeles. He said, "Yeah, I was." And Ajahn Chah said, "Don't worry. Out of the great compassion, I can help you. Next time you write to her," said Ajahn Chah, "ask your girlfriend to send something of hers back to you. Something personal, something intimate, so that whenever you miss her, you take it out. And that'll stop you being so sort of sad at the separation." And when I heard this, I thought, "What? I've never heard this in Buddhism before. I thought you're supposed to let go. That's more attachments. What do you mean? You know, ask her for like a lock of her hair, or like a piece of her dress with her scent on, so that when you're longing for your girlfriend, you can just, oh, that's my girlfriend." And I thought, this is crazy. What's Ajahn Chah up to? And then I found out, because he said it took a long time before the translator could actually get his act together and translate. He was laughing, he was just crying. It was whatever it was one of Ajahn Chah's funny jokes. And it was true, because Ajahn Chah told him, he said, "The next time you write, ask her to send you a little bottle. And inside, ask her to put some of her shit. So whenever you miss your girlfriend, open the lid of the bottle. Oh, that's my girlfriend back in LA. Isn't it the case you love everything about them? You're in love. I love everything about you, darling." "Really? Everything?" So that was Ajahn Chah's antidote to when you're in love with somebody. Because that's what happens. When you're in love, you can only see the beautiful part of your partner. And you're just blind to all the other parts of them. But real love is to see the full picture. Yeah, you know, they've got maybe a beautiful face or beautiful hair, but they've still got smelly shit. Just like everybody else. Yeah, you know, they may be so kind to you when they're in a good mood, but they get grumpy when they've had a bad day, just like you do. So just these are human beings. So after a while we change the idea of what love really means. We love the imperfect people. We don't expect them to be perfect. What was this? Okay, joke coming up. This guy, he was a millionaire by the time he was about 23. And he was a sports star as well. Really big and muscular, big pecs, gorgeous looking, wealthy, a really great catch for any woman. And so he thought, look at me, wealthy, sort of smart, rich, good-looking, I can marry anyone I want. So I'm going to marry the most perfect girl in the whole of Australia. So he went to Sydney, and he found this really, really beautiful girl. She worked as a model. And on the front cover of glossy magazines, he went out with her for a while and said, "No, I can't marry her. She couldn't cook." So he wanted someone to, cook in the house so they could share meals together. So he left her, went to Melbourne, and he found a girl who was even more beautiful. And she owned a restaurant. She cooked. Amazing girl. But he decided he couldn't marry her because she was stupid. Couldn't actually have a conversation, intelligent conversation with her. So he came, of course, to Perth. And in Perth, he met this girl, the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. She owned a chain of restaurants, and she cooked in all of them, only by invitation. And she had a PhD from Cambridge, another one from Harvard. She was just so intelligent. But he couldn't marry her either. Even though she was so perfect, he couldn't marry her. because she was looking for the perfect guy. That is what guys are like sometimes. You know, they're always looking for the perfect woman, perfect woman. And they should look at themselves. They're not perfect, so who would marry you? So if you see your own imperfections, you're very, very grateful that somebody will go out with you. You lower the standard. So if you want to have a good relationship, lower the standard. Don't expect so much. So anyway, that's, don't know why I got into that. Be obsessed about someone I love. Obsessions need to be balanced. So find out that part of that person which is not so desirable. You know, the negative side of them. Balance it. Don't go too far into the negativity, otherwise you get upset and angry. Whenever you get negative about your boyfriend, husband, wife, whatever, look at their good qualities. So you balance your relationship. So you don't get angry, negative, or so you don't get obsessive. You get real. Real people. Many of us in our daily lives would have office jobs. After 8 hours staring at screen and dealing with... It's actually amazing just how many monks do that. 8 hours staring at screen and dealing with the endless problems of working at a disorganized company. I know exactly what you mean. Please don't tell the committee that, Mahinda. He's our librarian. How can we relax our body and mind instead of using things like TV to distract ourselves from the tension that's built up in our head and the agitation and resentment that we feel in our heart? Why? Because it's more efficient to meditate. You know, if you're watching the TV, that makes you more upset. You see the news. All the politicians just always lying. All the business people stealing. All of the wars, people killing each other. All of your sports teams always losing. It's really depressing watching the news. That is why, and the monks will actually confirm this, I do look at newspapers. I got Saturday newspaper today. Actually, yeah, it was this morning. And what part do I read?
Jokes.
The comics, yeah. That's the only part I read, the comics. The rest of the stuff I give to the other monks. Got some good some of those comics are just really, really profound in those like Calvin and Hobbes is one of my favourite comic strips. Some of the things which he says is great. He was actually the one, he was talking to his school teacher, because he's an American, and he says, you just said ignorance is bliss. That's a very famous saying, ignorance is bliss. And the US Constitution guarantees me the pursuit of happiness. So I'm getting out of here. You're taking away my bliss by educating me. And one of the other things he once said, life in outer space. Is there intelligent life in outer space? And he says, the surest sign of intelligent life in outer space is the fact they haven't visited us. What intelligent beings would want to come to this mess? So there's a few really nice things these comics say. And that's much better than just staring at the screen. So, but anyway, even better than that is just meditating, because you find distracting yourselves is just, you're just not really dealing with the problem of tiredness. You're just, you know, pushing it aside, not watching and not looking at it. It's like putting a band-aid on the wound rather than treating the wound. So it just gets worse after a while. So all the tensions built up in your head, agitation, resentment that we feel in our heart, it will get worse and worse and worse and worse by watching the TV. You've done that before. So you know it don't work. So come over here instead. Meditate. I understand that this journey I have chosen to undertake will be an interesting one. Already my awareness is improving, especially when walking back to the cottage. Is it true that the ants on the path are assessing my awareness level and reporting back to you? Wow, you've busted me. There are my informants. They all creep into your rooms and tell me how much you're sleeping, what you're eating, because they get the remnants of your biscuits and noodles and whatever else you're sneaking into your rooms. No, the ants are the ants. They're free beings. It's amazing just how sensitive those things like ants can be to people, though. We When I first came over to Bodine Island Monastery 32 years ago, we built one of our buildings over there, and it was right next to an ant's nest. And I was so careful when I was doing a building, always to go around the ant's nest, never to disturb them at all. So they, on their paths, they went on their paths, I would step over them, I'd put the building material someplace where it wouldn't interfere with them at all. Extra work. But when I built that little small A-frame, I went to live in there, the ants would never bother me at all. But one day someone else drove a tractor right over the ant's nest. From that day on, they started coming into the hut. It's obvious, if you're kind to animals, they're intelligent beings. We proved their intelligence once because one of our Anagarikas, a trainees once, he gave them a test. He put, an ant's mound, he put a sugar cube on top of the ant's mound. Now, that's beautiful food for ants. They love sugar. They've got a whole cube there. The trouble is, it's too big to get through their holes. So it's an engineering problem for the ants. They solved it so beautifully. He noticed the sugar cube got a bit lower after one day, and lower. They were excavating from underneath to lower it. And then once it got to the level of the ant's mound, they put earth on top of it. They actually engineered to lower the source of food to the bottom of their nest for storage by excavating, instead of trying to pull it apart, excavating underneath and putting earth on top. Brilliant engineering. So yeah, they're amazing. Would you advise labelling an emotion thought when I become aware of it and return to body or breath? The labelling, you might try that in the beginning, but it gets a bit sort of, after a while it gets a bit tiresome, labelling everything. So it's much better just to learn how to make peace, be kind, be gentle. No need to label stuff. Too much labelling. Enjoying the retreat, couple of questions. Is it okay to meditate in the room? Do we have to come to the hall? No, excellent, that's a good question. You have your own little cave in your room. So I prefer to meditate in my room, so in the afternoons, in the mornings I come down here to meditate with you, give you some inspiration, to find out who gets up early in the morning, who doesn't. No, it's okay. So, please meditate in your room. It's really comfortable in there, and you've got your toilet really next door if you need to go to the toilet often. Please, meditate in your room is quite fine. But also, please make sure you're quiet, so that people may be meditating there in all times of the day. But please do not meditate on your bed. The reason is that pillows are magnetic. You'll find that your head gets drawn inexorably onto the pillow. You're on the floor next to your bed, it's fine. Walking meditation, is it okay to walk fast? I have heard this circulates the blood to legs and the exercise is good for the legs. Yeah, whatever you feel you need to do. If I get any indigestion sometimes, I love walking fast. It gets all the stuff moving in there. Circulation moves, the food moves, great to do fast walking. But sometimes you don't need that. Sometimes do slow walking, sometimes middle walking. So just whatever you need to do. So feel what your body needs. Experiment. Get a bit of feedback. If fast is what you want, do fast. Slow, do slow. When I look at my mind during the daily activities, if I see that my mind is attached to something and this gives me suffering, I suggest my mind give up. Is this a good practice? In daily life, sometimes not. If you find you're attached to something, gives it up. Because I always remember this monk, and he was having his daily lunch. We eat out of bowls. You see, if you go over to Bodhi Nyan, you see we eat out of a bowl. And this monk was pushing this food away. And then he pulled it towards him. And then he pushed it away. And he pulled it towards him. And he kept on doing this. And we asked him, what's going on? He said, but when I looked at it, I was so attached with desire to the food, so I pushed it away. When I pushed away, so that's just being arrogant and being proud. So I'm going to put it towards me and just eat. But then I'm being so attached, so I put it away again. Crikey, just eat the food. So if you're doing your daily activities and you like sort of washing up, please carry on doing the washing up. We need the washing to be done. So if it gives you suffering, Remember, you get much more suffering if you don't do the washing up. So if you suggest your mind give up, okay, if you really mean you give up the suffering, you just do it. And that's a good practice. So don't think about it. Remember, one of the Buddha's great disciples, Venerable Nike, just do it. Don't think about it. Washing up, just do it. Easy. Because sometimes people make it really, really complicated. Venerable Sir, you said let go for everything. Could you please explain, giving some examples? I'm not a native English speaker. Forgive me. Let go for everything. Especially when you are meditating, it's a time to let go of controlling, of wanting. Sometimes people ask me, what's the difference between letting go and letting be? Whatever's here right now, you let it be. And you let go of trying to change it, wanting it, controlling it. So you let this moment be, and you stop this trying to do something with it. Get rid of it. Judging it. So that's how you get very peaceful in meditation. However, when it is you're washing the dishes, and you've got this very expensive plate in your hands, please don't do letting go. Crash, crack. The same, I tell people, when you're on the back of a motorbike on the Gore Road in Colombo, as Mr. Lad can see it, don't let go. If you fall off, you're going to get killed. So there is a time to put forth effort. There is a time to let go. Meditation is a time to really let go. When it's the time to actually to brush your teeth or go to the toilet is the time to let go as well. But when you're doing your chores, please give it everything you've got. Three questions to go. What would you say to people who feel they want to read, draw or write on this retreat as they don't usually have time to do these things in real life? Is they want to read. Look, there's nothing worth reading. Yeah, okay, you can read on this retreat. Read your mind. You want to draw. Draw on the Dhamma and see the amazing teachings. And what's the last word? Got to think quickly here. They want to draw, read or write. And if you want to write, try and write on nothing, on the air. Can you write anything on the air? No more than you can really achieve anything. There's no one to pin the medals on. There's no place to hang the certificate. So why are you trying to achieve things? So why are you trying to write anyway? People told me, I heard this when I was a young Buddhist. And they said to me that anyone who writes, especially a book, if you write a book, according to the law of karma, this is Zen monk told me this, you'll have to spend the next 7 lifetimes as a donkey for writing a book. I've got many donkey lifetimes ahead of me. But it's true. I mean, what are you writing about? There's so many people write. And so many people speak, but not many people listen and understand. So see if you can listen and understand to your book of life. What's happening over here right now? That's what you should look at and read. That's the most important. And as for all the other stuff, you're going to get old soon and retire. If you don't wait till your retirement, the economy of the whole world is really going down the toilet right now, so you're soon going to get the sack. You're soon going to get made redundant. So you can do all your reading and writing then. So now you're meditating. Enjoy meditation and leave all that reading and writing until you've lost your job. I'm never going to lose my job. Become a monk and nun and I guarantee you job security. The pay's no good, but the retirement benefits are out of this world. Would walking meditation alone be able to get us to reach enlightenment? Or only this through sitting meditation can reach enlightenment? The only way to reach enlightenment is not through sitting meditation, not through walking meditation, not through vipassana. The only way to reach enlightenment is through 8 Eightfold Path. So what the Buddha kept on saying, Eightfold Path. Sitting meditation is part of it. Walking meditation is part of it. Keeping your precepts is part of it. So many parts of it. The right attitude, wisdom is part of it. All comes together. Last question. There is a belief that your last thought at the time of the death determines the sort of life worth you get next time. Please explain about this. Has somebody got plans of doing something tonight? Your last thought. Explain about this. How many of you have had those experiences you thought you were going to die and your whole life flashes in front of you? I've had that experience. When I was about 19, I was in Scotland and I fell down a cliff. I told someone about it recently. I fell down a cliff and I was in the middle of nowhere and I had a big heavy backpack on, not like this really high class, expensive, high tech backpacks. This is the old type, really, really heavy. And because it was heavy, I twisted around and I just saw the cliff right in front of me, going down, 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 almost forever, vertical cliff. And I thought I was going to die for sure. And in those, I was only 19 or 18, yeah, something about that, 19 or 20. Didn't have much of a life, but I remembered all the main parts of it. It was incredible. Just like, you know, people say, main things just flashed up in front of me. And then the next thing I knew, I could feel solid ground. I couldn't see, I could see the cliff in front of me. Didn't know what was underneath. And then just felt solid ground under my feet and just, you know, bent my legs at the knees to take the fall, rolled over and got up and I was fine. And I looked up and the cliff was only about 2 meters high. Maybe 3 meters. But that was just an amazing experience because at the time, you see, going, 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 this is a long way down. Time got really screwed up. Well, it only took a second, looked like it was minutes. And the short 3 meter cliff was about 30 meters to my perception. And it gave me all the time in the world, you know, to review 19 years of life. Weird experience. But that happened automatically. You can't decide what your last thought is going to be. It's a sum total of all you've been thinking. That's why. It is true, but it's not just one thought, it's a whole series of thoughts. Instead of saying your last thought, it would be much more like your last mind state. Whether it's anxiety, fear, anger, kindness, compassion, peace. It's not a thought, but your whole mind state, of which the thoughts are a reflection. So you can't fake it at that time, unfortunately. It's just nature. So, it's true. That's why when people are dying, we usually sort of tell them just to let go, relax, be peaceful. Because also the last thing is death is not a moment. As any doctors here know, death is a process. You can't pinpoint it to 1 second. It takes a couple of minutes to die. And doctors can't tell exactly when that was. They're roughly, you know, between about 9 o'clock and 9:05, somewhere around there. Because it's a process. Last question for tonight. If you get hurt easily by other people's doings, especially from your own dear and near ones, how can you ignore those without getting angry or disappointed? Lower your expectations of your near and dear ones. They're human beings. They're stupid sometimes. They're upset. Now, when I became an abbot of a monastery, I had such high expectations of my other monks. That caused me so much anxiety and upset. Now, after how long have I been heading this way? Over 20 years. Now I've lowered my expectations. I don't expect much of these scallywags next to me. All those nuns over there. When you don't expect very much, you can become far more peaceful and happy. I expected so much out of the Buddhist Society of West Australia. I've lowered my expectations to rock bottom now. And therefore I'm peaceful and happy now. Lower your expectations of Jhana Grove. And then you'll be happy and peaceful. We do our best. No, but you know, these things go wrong. Electricity went out this afternoon. Oh, it's our government. They haven't got any money left. They spend it all on Elizabeth Key, so their power poles are not working. Oh, just the nature of life. So that's actually, you get hurt easily because you expect too much. You're asking from your family members what they can't give you. So when you realize what people can give you, and you put your expectations much closer to reality, then you never get disappointed. You never get surprised when people stuff up. You can relax with your family members. And also, you never get upset when you stuff up yourself. Lower your expectation of others. Lower your expectation of yourself. And you'll be far more peaceful. Much closer to enlightenment. Sometimes in those Terry Garters I was talking about early, some of the people who got enlightened, the most hopeless cases, but they managed it. It means because you didn't have to be super person, super girl or super woman or superman to become fully enlightened. Ordinary human beings with all of their stupid characteristics. You don't need to have a university degree. You don't need to be smart. Don't need to be tough. Anyone can do it when they stop trying to force themselves to be someone else. So it's easy. Just let go. You lower your expectations of yourself, lower your expectations of other people, and learn how to be content instead of demanding. Just like we chant, this is what should be done. May you be contented and easily satisfied. Not proud and demanding in nature. How are you demanding of this retreat? Demanding of the weather? Demanding of me? Can you please stop? I want to go toilet. Are you satisfied? Some people you can't satisfy them at all. Other people are so easy to satisfy because they know about contentment. And your family members, they're not the best, but they're not the worst either. They're good enough. So when you are content with them, not demanding of them to be something they can't be, and you're the same with yourself, then you know the path to goodness. As we chant, as we brainwash you every day, twice. So there we go. That is the Q&A for this evening. I hope you're contented and easily satisfied. Whether you are or not my problem. Sadhu! 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 You're so impatient. Dude. Okay, have a nice night. See you tomorrow morning if you're still alive.